By the end of this decade, the World Health Organization estimates more than 2 billion people on planet Earth will need at least one kind of assistive technology, which means some product or service that makes it easier for a person to function independently. It can be as simple as eyeglasses or hearing aids, or as complex as a phone app that reads words in sign language out loud. Of course, these inventions are incredibly important for people with disabilities, but if you think about it, many are useful to everybody, like those closed captions when your TV is on mute or speech-to-text functions in your phone. Adaptive devices would seem like a huge potential market, but for the most part, tech companies are not making them a priority. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Some experts say the market for assistive tech is seriously undervalued. And until that changes, inventors with potentially life-changing ideas may have trouble bringing their products to market. Devi Lockwood has been reporting on this. She's an assistant editor at Rest of World, where you can find her article, Tech for Disabled People is Booming Around the World, So Where's the Funding? Devi, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
So give us a sense, I mentioned a couple, but the range of products that qualify as assistive technology.
I mean, it's all sorts of things. It could be an app, like you mentioned, that for people who have visual impairments makes the world around them sound like what we might see, right? Or it could be something like a swivel device that goes underneath a car seat, which is... makes it possible for people to get in and out of a car more easily.
And as we also mentioned, these things often prove useful to people with or without disabilities.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about the fact that I have aging grandparents, and earlier on in the pandemic, helped out with at-home hospice for my grandmother, and getting in and out of a car is something that is important for anyone, or, you know, myself even. I've had an ACL injury, and coming back from that surgery, right? A product like having a swivel under the car seat would have made life a lot easier.
Yeah, reading about that particular gadget, I was thinking about when my kids were small and they were in car seats. It would have been easier to get those things out had we been able to twist them around.
No kidding. I mean, I think the main idea is that designing for disability and for disabled people first ultimately has benefits for everyone. And disability is a fluid category, too. It's something that many of us, if we're fortunate, will age into. But there's so many different types of disabilities as well that are, important, and designing specifically for that can have benefits for not just that community, but for everyone.
I was first stunned in your piece to learn how many people could benefit from assistive devices. I was even more stunned to learn how many don't have access to them right now.
Yeah, well, so the majority of this population, based on some estimates, is in the Global South, right? And in here in the U.S., we have the ADA and other legislation that makes it easier for access to these products to be kind of mandated, or things like wheelchair ramps that, you know, we take for granted, handicapped parking spaces, things like that. But many countries around the world don't have that kind of legislation.
So tell us about Eric Ponce, who works in government communications in Ecuador and happens to be deaf and use sign language to communicate. How is he able to interact with colleagues who don't sign?
Yeah, so Eric is 26 years old, and he, in 2017, became one of the first users of an experimental app called SpeakLiz. And SpeakLiz is developed in Ecuador by a startup called Talov. And that app transforms written text to sound and can also transcribe spoken words and can alert a deaf or hard of hearing person to sounds like an ambulance, motorcycles, music, or a crying baby around them. So what was really transformational, I think, for Eric is that once he began using this app, his coworkers and his family were able to understand him more easily. His father told the app's engineers, "You can't imagine what it feels like to speak with your son after 20 years." And now Eric is part of the Talov team. So he demos new products to make them better before they hit the market. And I think that that's important because a common trap and something that it's easy for designers who are, you know, able-bodied or not a part of the disabled community to fall into is that they think they know all the answers, right? And so one thing that I think Tollive is doing really well is that it's incorporating voices of people like Eric right into the design process so that it's built in right from the beginning.
So how did the founders of Tollive, these guys, Ugo Jacome and Carlos Obando, how did they get interested in making these kinds of apps?
They both have really fascinating background stories. Hugo and Carlos went to high school together, and I think that they had, I'm trying to remember exactly what Hugo said. He had a teacher who was super impactful, who taught them both how to code. And the two fell out of touch, but both had kind of similar interests in using that knowledge to make the world a better place, right? And so their interest in designing to benefit the community in their country, in Ecuador, and now around the world, right? Because these apps are used globally, something that I think drew them together. And so Carlos saw a television special that had one of Hugo's designs that was based on a music, kind of bringing the sound of music into specific aspects of coding. And so as a result, they reconnected and decided that they would quit their day jobs and create this startup together.
And what does their newest invention, this app called Vision, do for users?
Yeah, so Vision is relies on artificial intelligence to convert real-time footage or photos from a cell phone camera into words that are played through the phone speaker. So this enables visually impaired people to hear their surroundings, like quote unquote hear. So for example, if the phone camera is looking at a banana or a Siamese cat, or a $20 bill, that by pointing the camera in the direction of those things, you will be able to hear the text. And the app also tells a person how far away each object is, can name colors, can read text on a restaurant menu, or even a street sign out loud.
Wow. So it's almost like for a visually impaired person, like having a sighted companion next to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't speak for that experience, mm-hmm. but from what I understand, exactly that.
So Ugo and Carlos have also updated SpeakLiz. So now it can sometimes read sign language and speak that aloud?
Exactly, yeah. So it's basic ASL or American Sign Language recognition using the cell phone camera. So this is the team's first attempt to recognize sign language without using third-party sensors. So this is, you know, a point where it's as much for the disabled community as it is for people around them, because obviously sign language is a perfectly valid and fantastic way, an efficient way to communicate, right? But for kind of bridging the gap where people don't know sign language, it can be useful.
So you mentioned that these guys were like, let's quit our jobs and do these projects that are good for humankind. Where did they get the money for this?
Yeah, so their first source of funding was $50,000. And that came in 2017 from a competition in Ecuador called Extraordinary Entrepreneurs League 3. And that was organized by the National Financial Corporation in Ecuador. And also in 2019, Tollive placed second in a competition that was organized by the History Channel. So that gave them a further $30,000. The thing was that that money was earmarked for really specific purposes. So that first prize from the National Financial Corporation, they used to build the AI platform behind their apps and you know, hiring folks who were very good at coding to make that possible. And then the History Channel money went towards providing devices for disabled people in Ecuador that are preloaded with Tollive's apps. So since launching, they've issued more than 200 free lifetime subscriptions, and they have about 2,440 paid subscribers right now around the world. But the thing is that relying on prize money from competitions isn't a sustainable business model. So here we get into the question of funding, right? FinTech app, for example, or a food delivery service in Latin America can raise venture capital relatively easy because those types of products are known for fast and profitable exits. But one thing that Hugo told me is that the startup like Talab, they're focused on making a long-term impact with different kinds of users that face different kinds of challenges. So while in a food delivery service, you can include theoretically 100% of all people, right? Disability and accessibility is more concentrated in a smaller group, or at least that's what a venture capitalist might think.
To be clear, users and tech critics alike love the stuff Talab has come out with so far, right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they've been very successful in creating something that works for the community. The main problem is funding.
I just don't understand why funders wouldn't be excited. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, food delivery apps promise investors that they'll be able to get in quickly and get out quickly with a lot of money. But we've just heard that all these like U.S. delivery type apps have lost just billions of dollars over their first few years. This seems like such a smaller risk.
Well, right. I mean, I think one thing that also came up in doing the interviews for this story is that there's a social stigma associated with disability to contend with. And some of the researchers I spoke with mentioned that, you know, there's this kind of widespread permeated ideology that disabled people are of lesser social value or of lesser importance. And so as a result, I think that stigma from what I heard in the reporting, can impact the way that a funder might see an opportunity like this.
Well, it is interesting that a company like Talab originated in Ecuador. That's a country whose president has a disability, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So Lenin Moreno is the president, and he's a politician who has been using a wheelchair for decades. And he became a wheelchair user after he was shot during a burglary attempt. So he was elected as Ecuador's president in 2017. And Talab's founders thought briefly that this might be good news, right? He's the world's only current head of state who's a wheelchair user. He served as the United Nations Special Envoy of the Secretary General on Disability and Accessibility, and he made disability rights a big part of his public persona. But 4 years later, after that election, from what I heard from Hugo at Talab, that Moreno's government has been mired in corruption charges. The administration has taken little in the way of action to address Ecuador's issues or making changes that would benefit disabled people directly. So it's perhaps an example of just politics being politics, right?
So Devi, one of the things you discovered when you looked into what the big tech companies, Apple and Google and the like, have done is that they've kind of taken this approach like creating these new technologies can be a pet project for engineers with a particular interest, which is different from making these things a corporate priority.
Absolutely. I mean, I think exactly what you said is what I found, that there's a difference. And I think it comes from the design process, right? From the people I interviewed for this story, it seems like the most successful products are often those that incorporate disabled people into the design process from the beginning and not just as an afterthought or to check a box.
How good are these companies' records on hiring people with disabilities?
You know, I don't have any numbers offhand, but again, my sense from the folks who I spoke with is that it could be a lot better.
So when they do decide to add assistive functionality to their products, what sort of input do tech companies invite from disabled users? Does this happen only on the back end? Like, does this work for you? Or are people with disabilities invited in to talk about what they actually want and need?
Again, I can't speak too much for Silicon Valley because I haven't been inside of that process directly. But I think that from the people who I interviewed for this story, the very best products will come from having a question that is trying to solve a problem, not for someone, but in collaboration with someone. And I think that there's certain communities that have really specific needs. So for example, another thing that I touched on in the story was how in India, polio was really widespread until the mid 1980s. And while it was eradicated in 2014, there's an entire generation of adults in India who live with mobility impairments. So one of the people who I spoke with is Anita Guy. She's a disability rights activist and a dean of the School of Human Studies at Ambedkar University in Delhi. And she's a part of that generation born in 1958, several years before the polio vaccine became commercially available in India. So she contracted the virus when she was 2 years old. She has no memory of an able body. And the aftermath of the virus made the use of a wheelchair necessary. And in New Delhi, her daily life is difficult in many ways. There's many grocery shops that have 2 to 5 steps before the front door, and she'll have to do something like wait outside for someone to bring her bread or a bar of soap. And as you can imagine, it's uncomfortable to just be sitting there and waiting for someone, right? And one thing that her story really made clear to me is that she's had to fight and have direct conversations with people in order to get small things like a standing wheelchair that she could use on the stairs in a movie theater that she frequents. And these are ordinary things, but the daily nature of those inconveniences is really grating.
Yeah, so many folks with disabilities say they don't want stuff done for them. They want the ability to do things for themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not that the problem is with the person who has a disability. It's the problem is with the world around them not being designed in a friendly way. And that's where I think listening and incorporating people into the design process becomes so important, right? And then there's design at the level of an app, but then there's also design at the level of what it's like to navigate through a city.
Yeah, one disability studies researcher that you spoke to for the piece noted that, like, the focus almost everywhere in developing assistive technologies tends to be about correcting the disability rather than correcting the things in the world that don't work for everybody. Can you explain the difference there?
Yeah, absolutely. So that researcher you mentioned is Amy Gaita, and she is a disability studies researcher at the University of Wisconsin. And in Gaita's view, right, there's really no problem with disability. The problem is with the world around. So the main motivation she noted for big companies is that they're trying to have a certain amount of social capital for looking woke, right? But perhaps in non-Western countries, that's not as much of a part of the design process. It's designing for necessity, right? For people like Anita or others of her generation of people who survived polio, right? But are living with the lifelong impacts of that impacts how they move through an urban environment.
I guess some of this is like the product of a vicious cycle, right? Because we don't necessarily see people with disabilities in all public spaces, in some cases because those spaces are not designed to accommodate their needs. And so people assume that there is no unmet need.
Yeah, I mean, it's the interventions shouldn't be ones in, again, speaking with Gaita, what came out of that conversation is that interventions to change disabled people to conform to the world around them are very different than something that would be the opposite, that's changing the world to make it more accessible for everyone. And then ultimately that makes things better, right? It's not a niche concern. It's a concern for all of us and something that is important to consider.
So in the United States, sometimes our solution to these challenges is to file lawsuits on behalf of people who aren't appropriately and equally served. Does that work around the world as well?
Not necessarily, right? So when I mentioned that example of Anita, one thing that she did was, you know, having to have conversations over and over again with this movie theater in order to get what she wanted, right? But that's exhausting, frankly. And we have legislation like the ADA here in the US that makes it possible for, you know, many parking lots here have at the very least reserved spaces for disabled people. And that's the result of a 1968 congressional act. But there's not always that same legal framework in other countries around the world that'll make it possible to have those things.
So is money the problem? You mentioned that Telov has, 2,400 paid subscribers. I will say that doesn't sound like enough to sustain any kind of company or subscription model. You'd struggle to get a local magazine up and running with that number of subscribers. Like, is there also a problem with getting the word out about this stuff?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely a problem with awareness. And that was one thing that came up in a conversation that I had with Anand Kutre. So he's a mechanical engineer in Bengaluru in India. And he created a product called Turn Plus, which is, like we were speaking about earlier, they're the ones that retrofit cars so that the seats can be swiveled. And it makes getting in and out of that car easier. And while the technology behind this is simple, right? They've struggled a little bit with getting the word out, basically. It's not yet available outside of India, though he's in conversation with a network of car dealerships here in the US. But this is the kind of thing that would benefit so many people, right? But it's the biggest challenge, Anand told me, was awareness.
I do want to talk for just a minute about some other reporting that you did with Leo Schwartz about medical device companies that are making it harder for users around the world to just fix things themselves rather than sending them back for bespoke parts or refurbishment at the factory itself. This is a real problem, and lots of good equipment is ultimately going to waste, right?
Yeah, so that was a piece that Leo Schwartz and I reported about focusing on incubators for babies who are born prematurely, and more specifically on the life of incubators in places like Tanzania, where specific hospitals are relying primarily on donated equipment sent from other countries that is several years old. And there is a right to repair legislation here in the US that has multinational impacts in terms of how easy it is for engineers on the ground in these hospitals to make necessary repairs when things inevitably break in these incubators.
Yeah, it was interesting for me to come across that because I have heard recently about farmers who are concerned that they can't like fix their very computerized tractors these days or can't have the local mechanic fix them for similar reasons. But the idea that babies are dying because we've made this hard is just untenable.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to consider the afterlife of objects, right? Or the life as it continues in other places, and how important it is to be able to repair things like incubators and tractors when they inevitably break.
What's the difference when you talk to young people versus very old people about these changes?
Gosh, it really depends place to place. The example that comes to mind is Tuvalu. So I spent a month there in 2014 to 2015. It's a coral atoll nation in the South Pacific that has 10,000 people. And the highest point is only about 10 feet above sea level, right? So they're very vulnerable to sea level rise, especially as it connects to the water table. So there used to be a freshwater lens under Tuvalu. And that was used for, you know, having shallow wells to drink, bays, et cetera. And in the last 20 years or so, that water has become both salty and contaminated from sea level rise, among other issues. And when I spoke with Tuvaluans who are my age, so when I was there, I was in my early 20s, and Tuvaluans my age, many of them were making decisions to leave this island nation that they've called home for generations. And there's a Pacific Access Category visa that New Zealand has set up with Tuvalu such that it's relatively easy for people to migrate. You kind of apply to a lottery, and there's a large amount of Tuvaluans who live mostly in Auckland, New Zealand.
So, it's legally easy. It isn't necessarily emotionally easy to leave.
Well, that's the thing, right? It's speaking with people about what it means to leave somewhere when your ancestors are buried there, right? It's really hard to leave home. And older generations of those I spoke to, they see climate as an act of God and don't want to leave because this is their home. So it varies a lot from person to person, but I think folks in my generation are having to make some difficult decisions about their future, because, you know, how many more years do we have left to live, right? But then things are going to change between now and then, or continue to change as they are.
Do you have a sense of what's going to make the difference, individual choices and actions, or sort of vast, you know, federal level policy changes?
No, it's got to be a mix of the two, right? I mean, I think individuals, as we were speaking, linking into part of our conversation earlier about, you know, having the privilege to speak up and speak out and push policy in a specific direction is one way of doing it. Thinking about systemic change is, of course, another important way, but I don't pretend to have any hard, concrete solutions. The most important thing for me is listening, right? And I think that by prioritizing the voices of people who are experiencing the impacts right now, only then can we begin to move in the direction of solutions that will not leave those people behind.
Did any particular trip leave you just depressed as opposed to hopeful?
You know... The two are just go hand in hand, right? I think about a young man, again, in my age, in his 20s, who I met in Kazakhstan, and he grew up in Afghanistan and lived in a community that didn't have access to safe drinking water. So his family would boil water from a river. And he lost his younger brother in an accident with that boiling water where it somehow fell on him. And that was the first time that he had ever told anyone that story, was when he told it to me. And it was such an honor to be able to witness that. But he, that man took his pain, right, from his childhood and transformed it. And now he works as a water engineer, and he doesn't want this to have to happen to anyone else. So I think that even from the deepest, darkest, most terrible pain, if we, you know, can take the time to see it in the right way. And one thing that he's done, right, is to use that as a motivation to try to make things better for other people in his region.
The upcoming book by journalist Devi Lockwood is titled, It's 1001 Voices on Climate Change. Is that right, Devi?
Yeah, that's right. And the subtitle is Everyday Stories of Flood, Fire, Drought, and Displacement from Around the World. It's available for pre-order.
All right. Thank you. Devi Lockwood is also assistant editor at Rest of World, where you can find her article, Tech for Disabled People is Booming Around the World, So Where's the Funding? Devi, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Chris, thank you for having me. And thank you to everyone who called in. This is fantastic.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. You can listen to Think wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.